Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Welcome indeed. Good morning. It is a Saturday and our special guest this week is multimedia journalist from Carbon Breathe, Roz Pearce. Good morning, Roz. How are you doing?
Okay, thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. And we also have first-time producer, Amna.
Hello.
We've got a great show coming up for you. So we're going to mix things up a little bit and we're actually going to start with our experiment because it takes like an hour. So we'll start it off and then we'll check in at the end. So because we've got Roz from Climate Brief, I thought we should do like a Carbon Brief even, a sort of climate-y related experiment. And what you're going to need for this is two bottles, about 1 litre is a good size. And you want them about a third full of water with a little bit of vinegar. And you also want a thermometer and some indigestion tablets like that you would take if you had a sore stomach. So Alka-Seltzer or antacid. And we'll tune back in after the first song to find out what you'll be doing with those. Roz, will you tell us what our first song is going to be?
Our first song's going to be by Talking Heads, called This Must Be the Place.
And why have you chosen that one?
I'm a little bit late to the Talking Heads party, but discovered them recently. Really good, turns out. Everyone else knew about them. Don't know why I didn't.
Great, so a new discovery. Here we go. What a lovely way to start the show. So hopefully you had time to go and get your bottles of water and, you know, a little bit of vinegar and your antacid tablets. We have got ours right in front of us, and you want to start just by measuring the air inside the bottle. So Rose, can you tell me how warm is the air in our bottle?
It's 21°C.
21°C, and is that the same in both?
Yeah, it's about the same, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, so that's what we're starting with. And what you're going to do now is we are going to drop some of our antacid tablets into one of the bottles. And you should see them starting to fizz away. And what they will be doing, it's an acid-base reaction because you've put a little bit of vinegar in with the water. And it's releasing carbon dioxide. So you want to get the lid on nice and quick and trap that carbon dioxide in the bottle. So everything is the same, except one of the bottles has a little bit of carbon dioxide in there and the other one doesn't. And what you want to do next is leave both of these bottles about 30 centimetres away from a nice bright lamp. And that lamp is going to start warming the bottles up. And in about an hour, we're going to come back and see if they're still the same temperature or if the CO2 has made a difference to one of those bottles. So there we go. We will be reporting back on that at the end of the show. And now it is on to science news. I think we all know what the main story of this week was. Just gonna fade that down a bit, but
bit of a sad story, this one. I think everyone's been following it. Sad story of the Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe, who this week was killed by an American trophy hunter. So I wasn't really aware of this, but trophy hunting is actually legal in many African countries, including Zimbabwe. But there's a lot of controversy because Cecil the Lion, who is a bit of a famous character in Zimbabwe, was lured out of the national park by the hunters and then killed. So there's been uproar. This dentist from Minnesota.
No.
It's been a bit of a witch hunt, really. Yeah, so
Yeah, Sasa had a lot of fans, and he was part of a research project, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's really interesting. The guy who's been tracking him for 20 years, and well, not quite 20 years, but he's been doing this conservation project, and Cecil was one of the lions in that. So it's really sad for the scientists involved, actually.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Cecil seemed like he had a lot of fans.
And it's also like even more sad, in fact, because the problem when you kill a male lion is that you're not just killing that lion. So that lion will have a pride of females. And if you kill that lion, then that pride is likely to be taken over by another male or coalition of males. Mm. And what happens when they take over, which doesn't actually get shown in The Lion King, is that all the cubs get killed. So you're not just killing adult lion, you're killing a load of baby cubs.
Oh, yeah, of course, because they want to make sure that nothing grows up without their genes.
Yeah, because infanticide is really common in lions.
Yeah, so if you're not mine.
Yeah, they just kill them all. So, I mean, I think I had about 12 cubs, so.
Oh, no. He killed one lion, he's killed 13.
Yeah, so.
But, so you were telling me earlier that actually the conservation parks that they have, some of them are funded by these trophy hunting organizations.
Yeah, I mean, so that's how many of the conservation parks in Africa originally started. I mean, we wouldn't actually have places like the Serengeti or the Masai Mara if it wasn't for, during colonial times, they were basically reserved for game parks, which, you know, right or wrong, that's how we now have ended up with these conservation areas. And that actually continues to a greater degree than people realize. Like, a certain number of lions are killed every year in all of these countries, and other animals too. But and that helps to fund these parks and encourages the African governments to keep them as places of conservation.
Oh, it's so complicated.
Yeah, so it's more complicated than you think.
It's like the conservation parks are obviously amazing and keeping these endangered species alive, but actually being partially funded by animal blood money.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I guess it's not the case with all of them, but wow. And on to some more uplifting science news. So obviously Ebola's been across the news on and off since about 2013, and they finally seem to have found a vaccine that they think works, and this is huge. The World Health Organization says it's seeming to be 100% effective at the moment. Probably as more data is collected, it might be about 75% to 100%, but it's been developed by the Public Health Agency of Canada and then the pharmaceutical company Merck, and they've had a case about 100 patients who were identified between April and July with Ebola. And once these patients were identified, they vaccinated all the close contacts around them. And within these rings of vaccination, not a single other case has occurred. It's absolutely phenomenal. It's so exciting that they actually might have found a way of stopping this deadly outbreak from happening ever again.
And how long will it be until this vaccine will become like widely available?
I'm not actually sure, but I mean, the fact that it's going so well.
Started, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've sort of, Medical Sans Frontières is, I think, bringing it out, and they're starting to vaccinate children with it as well, because it's been shown to be safe. So, yeah, onwards and upwards with the Ebola story. And Amna, you have a particularly exciting one this week.
Yeah, it's a bit terrifying, because you can now add cars to the things that can be hacked.
What?
I know. What? So
how do you hack a car?
I know. And so it's all about what we call the Internet of Things. And this is where all of the devices that we have talk to each other. And some genius thought, well, let's put that in a car. So it's on your dashboard. And you know, like the radio and the GPS that you have in your dashboard, and they all like are talking to each other.
Yeah.
Apparently, these hackers have found a way to essentially log onto your dashboard, and the things like the radio and the GPS is also connected to things like your brakes and, you know, the engine and the steering. And, you know, this vulnerability, they realised this was there. And then the hackers have been warning them about it for years, and they've just not really done anything about it because it would cost them quite a bit of money. So to show really how dangerous it is, they went out with this journalist from Wired, and they got him on this highway, and they were like, you know, we'll show you what we can do, and we won't hurt you, but it looked terrible. They were able to cut his brakes off, change his steering.
Oh my god.
They just blasted Kanye West.
God, I think that's the worst.
Hack attack, Kanye West.
Yeah. And since then, it was quite effective because they've recorded about 1 million cars because of this.
So they've taken the hint.
Yeah, and they, I mean, people, if you do have these Land Rovers, you've been told to update your software system because they think now they've been able to kind of block out.
Put some
hacking.
Sort of firewall on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so everyone's been urgently
oh my God.
Told to. I know. That
very
is really sci-fi. Terrifying. Yeah.
I actually watched a documentary about the sort of hacker group Anonymous the other day. And yeah, it's when they wanted to, thousands of them could sort of like crash down a website or, you know, block out people's phone lines. And just, yeah, if enough people wanted to get hold of the cars and cause literally havoc.
Well, terrorists, I suppose, is the story.
I mean, the hackers themselves, you know, when you read this really great piece by Wired, said, we were terrified because we realised we could hack into thousands of cars from the safety of our own couch. And they're just watching these cars on this highway and they could just target
whichever. It's like real-life Grand Theft Auto.
No! I was just reading it like, oh, this is not really a thing. And it really is. This is a thing.
Oh, wow. Gosh. That is terrifying. And then the final, like, tiny little bit of science news was Nigeria has been polio-free for a year. Calls for celebration.
It's amazing. I mean, so the World Health Organization are now just confirming no one's had any polio. And once they do, Nigeria is going to no longer be on the list of countries where polio is endemic. So there's only going to be two countries now, Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they're now on their way as well to getting rid of the disease. And we're now set to probably eradicate polio by 2018.
That is incredible. That's such a testament to modern medicine. I just think that's amazing.
And it's going to be the second infectious disease that we've completely eradicated.
Yeah, smallpox being the first one, right?
Yeah.
Wow, that is absolutely brilliant.
Vaccines are great.
Yay! Well, on that note, let's have another song to celebrate. Roz, what have you got next for us?
So I'm a big Kate Bush fan, so I picked Hounds of Love. Yeah, she's amazing.
Love that song. Excellent choice there, Roz. Thank you for that.
Thanks.
Now, you are, part of your job is being not only a multimedia journalist, but specifically a data journalist. Mm-hmm. And that involves creating infographics. How did you get into that? Because that's such a kind of niche, really cool area, really exciting.
Well, it's always something I've been interested in, both kind of science and art. And I think I studied a master's in science communication, mm-hmm. Which is sort of like a media course for science graduates. And it's not really, they don't teach you to do infographics or anything. I just started doing it myself, like learning the basics of Adobe Illustrator, and realised it was actually something pretty useful. And I think a lot of people are starting to realise that it's the way forward, you know, with the advent of like iPads and everything. Everything's becoming more visual, so what better way to present the news?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, was it just that you had seen a story and you wanted to see if you could visualize it, or how did you do your first one? Tell me about that.
I think it was partly because I read, well, the David McCandless book, Information is Beautiful, which like lots of people have seen. I think I read that a few years ago and was like, this is really interesting. I went to this exhibition at the British Library called Beautiful Science. So it was basically an exhibition of data visualisation, kind of through the ages, actually. I didn't realise it was so old. Florence Nightingale, one of the first, you know.
Really?
She designed an amazing infographic.
Really? What of?
It was of deaths in the army, basically showing that most of the deaths weren't from military action, they were instead from like diseases. So in that, because of her beautiful infographic that she made, she managed to persuade Parliament at the time to change the laws. Yeah, so she was in Crimea.
So how did she visualize it? Was it just
it was kind of, I'm not quite sure what the term is, a kind of radial one. So it was a circular It was sort of the year in a circle, and then different causes of death with different colours coming out and in.
Oh.
I'm trying to explain that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I did not know they were so old either. I thought it was all linked into the fact that we now have so much big data and just, you know, like loads of numbers to process. And obviously in Florence's time, we didn't.
Well, yeah, of course they were hand-drawn then, so it was a slightly different skill. Now, I mean, now you can use like coding to code amazing visualisations with vast data sets that just wouldn't really have been possible the time then. But yeah.
So you went to see this exhibition and you were all inspired by Florence.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, maybe this is something I can have a go at. So like many people at university thought, why not try the student newspaper? So I made only slightly about science. So every year Imperial does this student sex survey. So I made a massive infographic about the sex habits of students at Imperial.
Amazing.
And then I applied to my first job with this like big graphic I'd done, which I think graphically was good, but the subject was like not particularly professional. And I think my boss at the time was like, yeah, I think we'll have to interview her and see what she's like. Thought it was really funny. I actually did edit out a few of the like dirtier quotes from my application.
Wow, I think that's pretty bold, applying with an infographic about sex tastes.
Yeah. Well, it's science, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Unsummable, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that was how I got going. But climate change, obviously, quite a different topic to, sexual habits of students.
Yeah, so tell me about, like, your favourite one that you've made for your job.
I recently made one about, so we ran this big analysis using this thing called Altmetric, which is a big databasey thing. My colleague did most of the research on this piece, but looking at which different science papers made the biggest like kind of splash in the media and like online and on social media, and then I visualized this with like all the score that they gave it, like Twitter like mentions and Facebook mentions and stuff like that, and it's really really interesting to see, because it doesn't necessarily align with what scientists think are the most important papers.
Oh, really?
We also did an analysis of that, like in fact a few of the ones that made it into the top 10 are actually a bit controversial, because of course they get more talked about, and that there are quite a few about conflict and climate change. That's a story recently. There was a paper about how the drought in Syria actually might have, I mean, obviously not caused the Syrian war, obviously, but like exacerbated it.
Yeah, actually, I remember hearing someone talking about kind of how grain in Egypt, because of more, I think it's a similar thing, like more drought, less crops were growing, and actually having sort of food scarcity is what causes, well, could have been one of the reasons causing a lot of unrest and unhappiness with the government, and may have led to the Egyptian uprisings as well.
Yeah.
And it could all come back to something as basic as, you know, the weather has changed and we don't have as much food as normal.
Yeah, which is why things like the impacts of climate change are so difficult to understand, because it's not only scientific and physical, it's also social and all these other things that it's going to impact. So it's really interesting.
Fundamental. And so when we talk about infographics, we're talking about taking basically numbers and turning them into a picture. Would you say that's the basics of it?
Yeah, you're trying to help people to understand. I mean, sometimes it's not really, it is numbers a lot of the time, but sometimes, well, there's two types really. There's data visualization, which is just numbers. Then there's infographics, which could be explaining a topic, but not necessarily always including some numbers. But yeah, I don't know. Graphic designers are quite like strict about the difference.
Oh, I do apologise to any graphic designers out there listening.
But yeah. So you've just got to try, and I think our brains are more willing to understand something when it's like, you know, there's pretty colours and things like that. It's just easier. Well, it eases you into a topic.
In the way that they say a picture paints a thousand words, when you're looking at something, you can just immediately, you can see the ratios, the sizes, you can see, you know, a spread of colour, and instantly you can just take in so much more than reading through a table and having to process it all yourself.
And I think what it sometimes does really well is just, with massive numbers, it can help it can help us to sort of understand like how vast these. I think David McCandless's book does this really well. So just like helping us to understand scale of thing, you know, if it's just numbers on a page, you can't really understand that very well. Like yeah. Our brains don't work that way.
and another really important use I read was helping people to understand things that are just really hard for us to conceptually understand. Like the distances in space are so huge, mm-hmm. we don't really have anything to relate it to, or the forces as well. Like landing something on Mars, the force that rocket experienced.
Yeah, but I mean the classic way, of course, is to describe things in football pictures and things like that. But you can also do it visually.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. So fascinating, so interesting. And what song are we going to be having next?
I've got a bit of Motown lined up. So This Old Heart of Mine by the Isley Brothers.
If you've just tuned in, we are halfway through our show. We started the show with a little climate-related experiment where we have put some Alka-Seltzer tablets in one bottle of water to create some CO2 and have another bottle of water with no CO2. And we're going to see if they heat up the same in front of a lamp. If you think one is going to get hotter than the other, tweet us which one you think and we'll see who's right at the end of the show. I'm joined by Roz Pierce, who is a multimedia journalist working at Carbon Brief, and I've got a little game coming up.
Sounds ominous.
Yeah, Roz was not pre-warned. So obviously climate change and global warming is something that everyone is very concerned about, and you know, there's the multi-million dollar question: how can we help prevent it? Other than, of course, like switching onto renewables and lowering all our carbon emissions and stuff, which takes time and is difficult. There have been some other much more outlandish suggestions as to ways that we could, you know, cool down our planet or prevent it from getting any hotter. So I'm just going to read you a few, and I want you to try and guess if it's a real suggestion,
okay,
or if it's false.
Okay.
So one of these suggestions is to put giant mirrors in space. Is that true or is that false?
I think I've heard of that one before. I think that's a real suggestion.
Yes, it is. Several scientists have proposed shooting huge mirrors into space to reflect the sun's rays away from us, blocking out about 2% of the sunlight, to hopefully make sure we don't get quite as hot as we might otherwise. Okay, so true or false, plant fake trees to absorb some more CO2 from the air?
Fake trees, as in like plastic, or just plant more trees? I think more trees is definitely true. I've heard that one before.
So fake trees have also been proposed by a global research technology, and they look a little bit like lampposts with like a fan at the top, and they would be made of absorbent materials that would suck in the CO2, and they would be placed along kind of like motorways, mm-hmm. where you're getting a lot of emissions from all the cars. So I think planting more trees is obviously a much nicer idea. Yeah. It looks a lot nicer, but we've got these fake trees as well.
I suppose it could be useful in countries where like it's hard, you know, there's not so much water or something like that.
Okay, true or false, kill all the cows.
That's definitely true. That cows are a really big source of methane, and that is, yeah, actually quite a significant contribution to climate change.
So I guess I'm actually going to say this is false, because no one has proposed killing cows, like outright, like going out and killing them with a gun.
I think what I more meant was eat less meat.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it was a little sneaky for me, because we do know that the meat industry is a huge contributor to global warming. And yeah, going vegetarian, or at least cutting down, one of the best ways.
I discovered the other day that beavers actually are a big contribution to methane, which I didn't know.
In what way?
Because of their like building dams just like releases loads of methane. I didn't realise this.
I did not know that either.
So I don't think anyone suggested killing all the beavers, but
I don't think we have that many beavers, do we? Yeah, we have a lot of cows though. Okay, so the next one. Cows again raise garlic eating cattle.
That can't be true. Is that true?
Well, some scientists have actually suggested feeding the world's cattle a bunch of garlic because garlic is known to kill methane producing bacteria in the stomach of the cows, so they wouldn't fart quite as much. I mean, I think
you'd
this
think
is...
it would be the other way around.
I mean, I don't know if they can digest as well if they lose all these bacteria, but hey, less farty cows is a good idea for everyone. True or false, build giant haystacks over every mile.
I've not heard of that one, so I'm going to say it's false, but I suspect it's probably true. There's been some pretty out there suggestions so far.
No, you're safe with that one. That is absolutely false. Okay. And came from the depths of my brain. And true or false, cause a massive plankton bloom.
True?
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of suggestions of kind of seeding the seeds with more nutrients or even trying to stir up nutrients from the depths to feed the plankton at the surface because plankton are plants, or some animals, but a lot of plankton is plants. And if you could grow a lot more across the seas, again, that's another source to absorb a lot more carbon dioxide.
Interesting.
Don't know how else it would affect the sea, but...
Well, poor sea being, like, acidified.
It'll suddenly be green and not blue. I mean, I think that is probably one of the bigger issues with any of these strategies. You don't actually know...
It's hard to tell what the knock-on implications are going to be.
What the knock-on implications are going to be. Well done, Roz. I'm going to say you got 4 out of 5. Give me a high five. You survived the science game. And what are we going to have next?
We're going to have a song by Lauryn Hill.
To the man, all concerned with his rims and his Timbs and his women, him and his men. Come in the club like hooligans, don't care who they defend, popping yang.
And we are back in the room. Oh gosh, sorry, just jiggling around there. So this is the part of the show where we find out a little bit more about your job and what you do working at Carbon Brief for us.
So Carbon Brief was basically set up a few years ago because don't know if you've noticed, but there's quite a lot of misinformation about climate change in the media. So it's kind of set up to counteract that. So whenever there was, you know, a kind of a story in the media that slightly didn't give a balanced view of the evidence, we'd kind of fact check that. But now we've moved on a bit more to analysis and stuff like that.
Analysis of current research coming out?
So we're kind of split into what we do. We do a bit of science. So we cover the latest papers and analyse those, especially ones that are likely to get picked up by sceptics. And we also look at policy. So this year is a really exciting year for climate policy.
Ooh, tell me why.
Because in December there's this big, it's called a COP, Conference of Parties. So about four or five years ago, there was a big one in Copenhagen that probably most of you will have heard of, where all the governments, UN parties, tried to thrash out a global climate treaty, and basically
absolutely nothing happened.
Failed miserably.
I remember the Now show doing a joke about it, where he was like, "This is what happened," in the style of Dr. Seuss's "The Cat Sat on the Mat." And he's like, "The delegates came and the delegates sat and they talked till their bums weren't flat." Like, it goes on for 5 minutes, and they're all sort of saying, "We should do something quick, but just what should we do?" And you know, at the end, they still had decided absolutely nothing.
Stayed there seated, sitting
and thinking, "The planet's been heated."
Well, this time it's actually looking a lot more optimistic. Everyone's saying it's going to be more optimistic, partly because things have moved on quite a bit from 5 years ago. The science has moved on, policy's moved on. Obama is in charge in the US. And there was also this recent thing about last, I think it was about like last November, where the US and China like signed a, well, they didn't sign, they kind of basically made a pledge to cut carbon emissions together, which is, which nobody really saw coming. That was a big shocker. Very exciting.
Do you think they're going to stick to it?
Well, they've definitely pledged to like, to make an effort to do it, so it's gonna look bad on them if, like, you know, if they don't try. Something should come out of this one, but I mean, what's being debated and what's like, it's gonna be like how legally binding this climate treaty will be. I think everyone's gonna pledge to cut emissions, but it's just how strong that will be.
And like, so when you say how legally binding, so is that, are they trying to decide at this conference if people don't stick to their pledges, then they get sued? How does that work?
Well, I think, I mean, some people are really pushing for that, especially there's this alliance of small islands, low-lying islands, called the Association of Small Island States, and they're obviously very at risk from climate change. Places like the Marshall Islands are just gonna, like, as sea levels rise, they're basically gonna have to migrate. Wow. So they really, really are pushing for
really
that
keen.
As are NGOs like Greenpeace, but of course, like, oil producing nations are less keen, so it's sort of about like what's going to happen there. It's kind of, it's very tricky to negotiate, and also the US is like, it's less likely they'll sign something that has very strict like enforcement on stuff like that. But yeah, so we'll see.
So the big power is kind of pushing back slightly.
Yeah,
don't breathe down my neck. Wow. What do you most, like, what do you guys kind of predict what you think might happen, or?
Oh gosh.
No, that's fine.
I don't think I'm well informed enough to to make predictions, but I'm feeling more optimistic than I was 5 years ago.
I mean, whenever I sit down and think about climate change and really think about it and really look into it, I always just feel so overwhelmed with kind of how terrible the outcome looks. I mean, do you find it quite depressing working?
Well, I did wonder that when I first like got the job and was going to work there. I thought this is just going to be really depressing, but actually day to day I don't really think about obviously I do think about the big picture, but actually more's being done on it than I thought initially. I think I just was really fatalist before. I just thought, okay, we're just screwed, like that's it. But actually, like, you know, people are trying to make a difference. There's all this UN stuff, like UNFCCC stuff is happening, and also there's these movements like the Keep It in the Ground campaign by the Guardian, the divestment movement, where it like quite often we get big announcements of universities who've say they've divested from fossil fuels or other big companies.
Yeah, that's true. More and more people are trying to be green and clean.
Yeah, there seems to be things are happening. But whether or not, I mean, it doesn't, I mean, we're certainly going to get like some warming, or we already had 1.85 degrees of warming.
Oh wow. Did you hear the news about the Danish...
Sorry, 0.85.
I was like, oh, yeah.
Not 1.5.
Yeah. Big difference. Did you hear the news about Danish citizens suing their government for not keeping their climate pledges?
We actually featured that on this show a couple of weeks ago.
So, do you think with this upcoming climate conference, if people sign pledges, can citizens come forward and say, you've signed a pledge, this is this legally binding pledge? Do you think it might become the era of citizens making sure their governments do the right thing?
Citizens holding their governments to account.
Yeah. Well, maybe, but there's like a subtle difference in legal writing, for example, between committing to cut emissions and committing to specific numbers. By a certain point, that committing to try to cut this amount and committing to actually doing it.
So that's what they're going to be debating, basically, how vague is the pledge.
And I mean, at the moment, all these pledges are coming in from around the world, which do have numbers on them.
Yes, I saw your great infographic about that.
So numbers are being thrown around, but it's whether or not they're bound to try to do those or to like actually do them.
Do you know what the UK is pledged to?
Oh gosh, I can't remember off the top of my head. It's so the UK is part of the EU has made a pledge together.
Got it.
I'm not going to try and remember, but it's something like 30%, and it, of emissions by 2030 or something. Oh God, I'm gonna have to go and check that afterwards.
That's fine. Don't worry. I just put you on the spot there. I was just curious. Yeah, what we were promising. Wow. Oh, big stuff happening in December then.
I mean, one other question that I've been thinking about is, so a lot of developing countries, their economies are going really, really quickly. And a lot of that has to do with them, you know, using non-renewable fuels. Mm-hmm. But they haven't, you know, been the main cause of climate change. So in one point, they're like, we have serious issues of poverty and hunger. Yeah. And this is one way of dealing with it. And they're quite, I think, pissed off that people are coming to them and like, you should invest in green energy, and they're like, well, you know, we're not to blame for this massive mess, but how can we, you know,
that's why you need people like America to take the lead.
So what, you know, do you think that will be discussed, like really big developing countries like India, and I know really huge countries in Africa?
I mean, India has a lot of uses a lot of coal for that reason, and it is like generally agreed that these developing nations should be allowed like to have more coal and stuff like that, just to get them off the ground. But actually in countries like India, emerging technologies like solar are really, really useful because India is so massive that it doesn't have a national grid like the UK, like loads of places are off grid, and having things like solar where you can just generate it anywhere is really useful. But I think also these countries are like starting to realize that they will be really badly affected by climate change, even if, like, you know, if they didn't cause it. And there's also things like the Green Climate Fund to help
a bit like the Global Bank or something, to fund green,
like,
projects around the world,
countries, help them to go green. So yeah,
And you do hear more and more about like kind of cool social startups or like things on Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. Someone told me about something called Gravity Light, which is using a weight, and it takes sort of 2 hours for this weight to fall, and the energy of it falling generates light for a light bulb. Mm-hmm. And then every 2 hours you just wind it up again and let it slowly fall, and that gives you your light. That's incredible. It's just like green light, and like you said, like places that don't have a national grid or something, you could just set this up in your house, and so I guess hopefully seeing more and more of those sorts of things. I think it's time for a little bit more music. What are we having next, Roz?
We're gonna have a song by Josh Ritter called To the Dogs or Whoever.
Don't ever care about the in-betweens. Comb the hair with the blade, did the maid of Orleans. Said crosswalk the water, we can wade through the war. You don't need to tell me who the fire is for. And bring me a love that can sweeten a sword. A boat that can love the rocks on the shore. The love of an iceberg reaching out for the wreck. Can you love me like the crosses of the neck on the neck?
So you are listening to Soho Radio. It's the Saturday Science Club, and it's almost time for us to say goodbye. It's been absolutely fascinating having you on, Roz. Thank you so much for coming. Like, I've learned so much about climate policy, infographics, and even Cecil the Lion. But before we go, it is time to check out how our experiment has been doing. So looking at them. One's definitely looking
a bit cloudier.
I'd even say there's a little bit of condensation has formed in both bottles, and there's definitely a bit more condensation in our CO2 bottle. So I think it's looking like a good sign.
Yeah, it's quite fizzy, so definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, moment of truth. Now, we only have one thermometer, unfortunately, so we're going to have to do this one at a time. So we're going to open our normal bottle first and see what it's reading.
So it's reading 22, so a little bit hotter than before.
22, yeah, excellent. And now we're going to go to our CO2 bottle. And I'm just looking at it now. It says 23. But yeah, oh my God, so a whole degree warmer. It kind of worked. Yeah, brilliant, a whole degree warmer. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot to you listeners at home, but it was only there for an hour, and some CO2 has made it a whole degree warmer. I think we can say that is a success and has demonstrated the heat retaining properties of carbon dioxide, which is why it's called a greenhouse gas. So on that note, final song to play us out.
Got some Destiny's Child. Don't think there needs to be a reason.
Okay, this is Destiny's Child, Bills, Bills, Bills.
my car. Gave me back credit, buying me gifts with my own hands. Haven't paid the first bill, but you said heading to the mall. Going on shopping sprees, perpetrating to your friends that you be ballin'.